This is Strange Harbor.
4,500 years, 2,500 BC. It's called it's VA 243. It's in a museum in Berlin. It's well dated. Called the Granting of the Plow. But this is what makes this special right here. Solar system, right. Sun, Mercury, Venus, Earth, in their relative sizes, mind you. Earth, Moon, Mars, and then, what should be here? This should be the asteroid belt. This is Nibiru, folks. Nibiru. Jupiter, Saturn, Pluto as a moon of Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. Notice that it's only a little bit bigger than Uranus, Neptune. It's about three times bigger than Earth. Did it occur to any of you that we were looking at a cylinder seal carved 4,500 years ago that had Uranus in it that we only discovered in 1781 when our telescopes got good enough to see it? It had Neptune when we discovered in 1846 when our telescopes got good enough to see it, and Pluto, which we discovered in 1930 when our mathematicians got good enough to tell our astronomers where to look for the thing because it was so small. What are the Sumerians doing knowing about that? Furthermore, what are they doing writing in one of their tablets that if you look at these two, Uranus and Neptune, in the heavens, meaning right out on them, they look like blue-green watery twins? When we didn't find that out, we thought they were just big old gas bags like Jupiter and Saturn until Voyager went out there in 86 and 89 and found that, lo and behold, they really are blue-green watery twins. What the Sumerians said 4,500 years ago. Furthermore, they didn't count the way we do. Earth was not the third rock from the sun for them. It was number seven. So that means they were counting from out here and they were putting Pluto in its correct place. What are they doing with all that knowledge? Well, they make no bones about it. They say everything that we know, everything that we are, everything that we have comes from the people living on Nibiru. The people living on Nibiru came to Earth and gave us everything that we have, everything that we know, our great culture. What's the proof of that? Is there any proof that any ancient advanced civilization was ever on Earth at any point in the dim or distant past? Yes, yes, the megalithic structures out there, the pyramids, Tiahuanaco, Baalbek, Teotihuacan, Stonehenge, you name it, a couple of dozen of them. All of those are impossible for human beings to recreate today. And yet we are told in another one of these great fantasies that they were somehow created by people in ancient times, ancient Egyptians or ancient Sumerians or anybody. And it's just absolute malarkey, impossible.
Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, and all things strange. This is Strange Harbor.
And another exciting episode of Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird.
The strange, the undead, and the unliving.
Welcome back, Billy.
Welcome back, Johnny.
You got your new eyeball.
I got a new eyeball. This one is Seattle Mariners eyeball. And It's been like less than 48 hours since it was made, and it's already famous. So.
Yeah? More famous than the Mariners record right now?
They're doing all right, hey.
Okay.
They're in first place right now.
Okay, I must retract that snide comment.
Only 160 more games to go. But
nice. Well, our guest today on Strange Harbor is known around the world. He was in law enforcement in San Jose for, 20 years? Then he went into technology, and now he's an author living in Colorado, Mr. David Palaides. Welcome to Strange Harbor.
Hey, thanks, Johnny. It's great to be on your show.
Bill and I both have read your books, Missing 411. And I want to do this part real quick for someone who might not be familiar with Missing 411 or your work. First, welcome to Planet Earth because, your work is quite famous. You had worked with, Search and Rescue, and you started to see kind of almost like a trend or kind of a problem with people coming up missing in national parks. Is that correct?
What happened was I was doing some peripheral research at a national park, and some guys happened to know me and were following me around, some rangers, and that's not unusual. I was talking to some of the workers that work the concessions at the parks because they're usually easier to approach and talk to and they're more open. And I got back to my lodge at the end of the day. One of those guys knocks on the door and he goes, "Hey, I know who you are. I want to talk to you. There's been some things happening. We want to fill you in." So he comes in and he starts telling me that he's worked at a series of national parks, and during that time he'd worked a lot of search and rescues. And he noticed that there was a lot of publicity, a lot of effort during that first 5 to 7 days, and then there was nothing. And he said oftentimes he would get thwarted in his attempts to get information about the missing cases. And he thought that the cases were odd because of the places where the people were disappearing. And then another individual came to the park, another ranger, and they started comparing notes, and they got together and they said, wow, you know, there's something odd going on here, and somebody really ought to look into it. That's why they approached me. That's how it all got started years ago. When I left that scenario the next day, I got a hold of a couple of guys in law enforcement. I said, hey, can you check these parks and see if there's a number of missing people? A couple hours later, I get a call back and go, wow, there's a lot of people missing there, and nobody seems to know. So what I did was I first filed a Freedom of Information Act request against the National Park Service Police, asking for a list of missing people from their jurisdiction. Now, any one of your listeners could go into any small to medium-sized city in your state and go to the police chief or the sheriff and ask them for a list of missing people in their jurisdiction, and within an hour, that person would have a list on his desk. I can guarantee it. Well, the National Park Service, about 3 months later, I get a call back from an attorney from the National Park Service asking me why I want that list. Well, according to the Freedom of Information Act, they cannot ask you those questions and use it as criteria to give you the information. And I told him that. I said, that's a really odd question to ask. He goes, oh, we just want to know. And I said, it's just for research. And he says, well, we don't keep any lists of missing people. I said, what? And he goes, we have no lists of missing people in any of our parks. And I said, how can that be? And he goes, oh, no, we really don't. And so I thought about it. I said, okay. So I went back. I talked to my guys again, and we thought it was maybe a semantics issue in our request. We rewrote it, submitted it again. Again, a different attorney calls and says, no, we understand your first request. We don't have any lists. So I said, well, I'm a published author, so according to the Freedom of Information Act, I can request that you put a list together for me without cost. And I'm interested from all your jurisdiction. National parks, national monuments. He said, okay, I'll get back to you. A month later, I get an email back saying, your books aren't in enough libraries to qualify for the exemption. It's refused. Well, just so your readers know, there's no such exemption in the Freedom of Information Act. They made that up as an internal criteria for them to just dismiss my request. And I said, okay, well, if that's it, tell me how much you're going to charge me to put together that list. I'll just pay for it. They came back and they said $1.4 million. And if you want it just from Yosemite National Park, that's going to cost you $34,000. That was
amazing.
9 years ago. In the National Park Service Police, there's the obvious lawman to walk the beat in the park in uniform carrying guns. Those are great people, salt of the earth, fine people. It's the administrators at the top that are giving us the problems. And if there's a major crime or a missing person that's not solved, the case gets handed off to what's called a special agent in the National Park Service. One special agent in Yosemite that supervises six agents on the West Coast put together a list of missing people in Yosemite. This was after I wrote about 50 people missing in Yosemite, and then he put out the list. That is the only list that exists that I know about, and still the Park Service refuses to acknowledge that they probably do have a list, but they won't release it.
Why do you think that is?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. I mean, there's a whole series of great investigative reporters around the U.S., I've talked to many of them. George Knapp, one of the best, says they're blatantly lying to us. They have a list. They won't give it. Why they won't give it, who knows? But they won't give it.
Could it possibly be because they don't want to shed darkness on the national parks?
I think it's stupidity, honestly. Because they're just pouring gas on a fire, which fire would probably go away if they just released the list.
Right.
I mean, I've written 8 books. I've written about hundreds of disappearances in the parks, and with no help from them, it's just pure doggedness going through archived files and newspaper articles and digging to find who is still missing in these parks.
And what are you finding from all of this?
I'm finding, originally we focused just on national parks, and then we found cases just on the periphery of national parks in national forests. And then we found cases in property that belonged to the Department of the Interior. Well, we did the same thing with those jurisdictions and sent them a Freedom of Information Act request asking for a list of missing people. they refused as well, saying, we don't have any lists. And the National Forest Service has a law enforcement portion of their department that does law enforcement work. Now, understand, the rangers that are police officers in national parks and in the national forest have the best training in the world at the National Law Enforcement Training Center in Georgia. Those guys know exactly what they need to do, what they should be doing. They know the importance of keeping lists. You know, you could file a list against Mount Rainier National Park and ask for an inventory on all the toilet paper they have in that park. You would get that in 30 days.
Or less, but, yeah.
But you ask them for a list of missing people, they don't have it.
How about hunters? Many hunters go missing in national parks. Well, can you hunt in national parks? That's how much I don't know about that.
No, you cannot.
Okay.
But it's a good question. One of my books is titled Missing 411 Hunters. It's a book just about hunters that have disappeared, mostly in national forests, Department of Interior property, etc. And that's a unique subset of the missing. Because if you think about it, a hunter is armed. They usually come well-equipped. They usually know the area they're hunting in very well. A lot of those people have gone missing. And it's an oddity that originally when we looked at it, we didn't understand it. And admittedly, we probably still don't. But there's a lot of hunters that are missing that have never been found, that are really never talked about. You may hear about it on the news or in your local paper, you know, a hunter's missing here or there, blah, blah, blah. 7 days later, you'll never hear about it again.
So what constitutes a missing person? I mean, people go away all the time or run away from home or run away from friends and family. So what separates them from these missing persons that are listed as missing persons?
If you go out and you read, say, 4 or 5 missing person cases from various jurisdictions, you won't learn much. You read 500, you start to glean some interesting things. You read 5,000 like we have, and some things fall out, and you say, wow, those are odd. Now, you develop criteria, which we did, to throw cases out on missing people that are classified as missing people that we won't research. Part of that criteria is if there's any evidence that it's a voluntary disappearance, meaning there's mental illness, the person hated his wife, just wanted to get away, so he dropped out of society. Let's say he was last seen heading towards the mountains. Those kind of cases, we won't investigate. If there's any evidence of animal predation, meaning a hunter went into the woods and they found a scene where everything was tore up, they found his coat in shreds, they found pieces of or portions of blood in the environment, we won't investigate those. If there's any criminal evidence, any evidence of a crime in the disappearance, we won't work that. So the cases you find in my 8 books are screened for all of those things. And if any of that exists, you won't find it in the book. Now, these are the strangest of the strange cases. These are the ones that people throw up their arms and say, we don't know what happened. And from reading 5,000 cases, you notice certain what we call profile points that come up time after time, and those are the cases that we've centered on. Now, those profile points include: they bring canines to the scene where the person was last observed, and the canines can't pick up a scent. That's in about 99% of the cases I write about. Another one is there's a weather event associated with the disappearance, meaning just before or as the person is disappearing or as the search and rescue is evolving, there's some type of weather event. That could be snow, rain, wind, a multitude of things, but something that encumbers or inhibits the search. The other one is a victim, if they're found, they're found in an area that's previously searched. Now, this is not, underlying not an indictment on search and rescue. And this isn't saying that they didn't do a great job. But these victims are found in areas that have been searched sometimes 20 times. In one incident, the victim was found laid across a trail that search and rescue took every day to go out to the search scene. Oftentimes, the missing are found without clothes or shoes. Now, some searchers say, oh, well, that's because it was hypothermia. Well, in the incidents we write about, it's too close to the scene where they were last observed. There was no time for hypothermia to hit that victim. Another criteria is the victim has some type of disability or illness, and it may not be obvious, and it may only be uncovered after you talk to their family. but it's a strange kind of thing. A lot of them have, say, diabetes, or they have a very small heart condition, or they have some type of illness or long-term disability that nobody even knew about. Missing are disappear or are found very near water. That could be a creek, a swamp, or a bog. Same thing, they're found near boulders or granite fields. And one of the biggest ones is called point of separation. Something happens at the point where the hiker, the hunter, whoever, when they're in the wild, when they separate or they aren't seen by others. And that's when something happens and they disappear. And then the last one is equipment malfunction. A lot of times a victim will say, yeah, my compass didn't work. Or they had a walkie-talkie, the radio didn't work. It's those kind of things that are unusual that we can attribute to this. So all of those things together combined are what we look for in the cases that we research. Now, after doing looking at 5,000 cases, screening them down, and writing about them, there's 59 geographical locations in North America that match this criteria on missing people. And a cluster means three or more people that have disappeared in that area. Now, Washington State has 5 of these geographical clusters, a lot for any state. Olympic National Park, Mount Rainier, Mount St. Helens, the area near Spokane. Those areas have many disappearances. In total, I've written about 70 cases from Washington.
Wow.
And, you know, we're right at the gateway of the Olympics here, and we don't really hear much about disappearances.
You know, and that's, to me, a really sad thing. And Johnny, you know, I spoke at one of your conferences, and I gave a presentation about the disappearances of 5 young men from that Olympic area and Aberdeen area that nobody will talk about, nobody wants to address, but damn, they're gone, nobody has seen them, they disappeared, but there's a lot of similarities to those cases that fit our criteria that I've written about. And there was no evidence that anybody abducted them. There was no evidence they went in the water. They just disappeared. And it's those kind of things that is frustrating from my end when I look at it and I think, I don't think anybody's put these pieces together. Now, when you talk about the Olympics and you talk about the coast on the north side of the Olympics, what are you looking at? You're looking at an island across that belongs to Canada. And on that island, back in Vancouver Island, there's a whole series of disappearances that exactly match what I talk about. There's one in Tofino that is a disappearance of another little boy that exactly matches what was happening on the coast on the Olympics.
I've read I read one of your books, and it was fascinating. I loved reading the stories. You didn't give any kind of speculative conclusion about any of the cases. Why is that?
When you speculate without hard evidence, you're a fool. And you're giving people ammunition to hammer you later on when you're proven wrong. If I have hard evidence as to what's happening here, I am going to stand up and yell it to the world. I don't know. There's people who do research on things for their entire life and never come to a conclusion about what's happening. Hopefully that's not me. But I've learned a lot in my years in law enforcement, and that is to don't say things that you can't support. And I suppose that's one of the notoriety I have as a writer, is that I haven't tried to stuff things down the reader's mind to get them thinking a specific way. I'll allow the reader to come to their own conclusions about what's happening here. I'll admit, I'm pretty good at putting together evidence, putting the cases together, doing the hardcore research. But I'm not an expert on the variety of possibilities that may be happening out there in the world to these people. I don't know. I'll tell you right straight up front, it's not normal what's going on. And I gave a presentation in front of the largest search and rescue organization in the world. It's called NASSAR. And a huge room of people. And at the end of the presentation, 2 Alaska state troopers stood up in the back of the room and said, Dave, you're saying what we all know, but refuse to talk about. And they said, if anybody in here has been in search and rescue and have done a lot of these in the last 10 years, then you understand exactly what Mr. Politis is talking about, because it's happening to us regularly. And he goes, thankfully, somebody is willing to talk about it.
Wow.
That was a good explanation. Thank you. You know, I think that when we watch television and they talk about Bigfoot and UFOs and all this stuff, alien abduction, they give us a lot of information, and they kind of speculate as to what it could be, and then they lead you in a certain direction. I didn't find that your books were that way. I mean, they're straightforward, very factual, written in a way that tells the story without leading the reader. And it was actually quite refreshing to read that and not feel like you were trying to pull us down one path or another.
You know, there's enough rabbit holes to go down without me opening up another one.
Yes.
And the reality of it is that over the years, I've met a lot of victims' families. And those families always ask, Dave, what is going on here? Blah, blah, blah. Well, the reality of writing books is that people will interpret them the way they want. And there's a lot of people out there who have written some things about the books that are completely not true. Dave said this, Dave implied that. No. And one thing I think it's important is I want to make myself available to those victims' families out there who need an advocate for them on an evolving case involving a child, a friend, a relative, a husband, wife. Because in search and rescue, there aren't many advocates that really know what's going on. And you're at the whim of that search and rescue commander that's out there. And they may say one thing that may not be true. And they may say they can't do something that they realistically can. 99% of the time, the search and rescue people are the best in the world. And people don't understand this. The 99% of all search and rescue is done by volunteers. They go out, they get certifications on their own, they train on their own time. If there's a 7-day search for a victim, hey, they have to take that time off work. They're not getting paid. They're not even getting compensated. They're doing that for the love of the job and trying to save someone's life. And the commanders, that's probably a different scenario. Most of the time, they're either a sheriff, police officer, supervisor, someone in the national parks or the Forest Service. Those people are only as good as their training, and only as good as the number of times they've been in the field doing that. And that runs the gamut. I've seen complete, utter failures, and I've seen guys that have done tremendous work, and ladies that have done tremendous work. So it really is a fluke that if you're a victim of something like this, what's going to happen and how it's going to evolve.
Well, it's Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird, and coming up more with David Politis of Missing 411.
You're listening to Strange Harbor, ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor, be strange.
Welcome to Strange Harbor. If you've had an out-of-the-ordinary experience, then come to strangeharbor.net and let us know what it is.
It's Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird, and our guest today from Missing 411, what, 8 books, David Politis. Do we have a 9 coming?
Well, Johnny, I've been pretty busy. In January, I had a special on the History Channel called Vanished. I don't know if maybe some of your people saw it. It was a 2-hour special about my work. And we have a movie that came out about a year and a half ago called Missing 411. It's on Hulu and Amazon and iTunes. And I'm always working on something big. and I've got a couple big projects going on. I can't say that there's going to be another book in the imminent future, but there's probably going to be something better, hopefully, in the next 4 to 6 months. And I do a lot of presentations at conferences and things around the U.S., so you'll see me somewhere soon, hopefully.
You've talked about over 5,000 cases. Now, we wouldn't expect you to, you know, memorize any or all of them. Are there any cases that stand out that you could share with us today?
So I've read 5,000 cases. That doesn't mean I've written them. Of those 5,000, I kind of gleaned it down to 1,200 that I've written about in the 8 books. There's a lot of cases out there that, you know, strike you as odd. You and I are both parents, so the kids' cases always have bothered me. There's a case out of the Great Smoky Mountains involving a boy, 6-year-old boy named Dennis Martin, that happened in 1967. He and his dad and his grandpa went up for Father's Day camping with another brother, and they were there in the woods just having a great weekend, and kids are running around, and the Martins are sitting in their chair while the two boys are playing in the field, and this other family walks up and goes, "Hey, can our boys play together?" And you got to understand, this is about a 4-mile hike into the wilderness. There's this big open field right next to the Appalachian Trail, and his family walks up. Not unusual. "Hey, can our kids play together?" "Sure." So the kids are running around. They decide they're going to play hide-and-seek. So Mr. Martin watches Dennis 30, 40 feet away run behind this tree. After a couple minutes later, everyone says, "Okay, come on out." Dennis doesn't come out. Now, there's nobody else around. This is way in the middle of nowhere. He runs over to the tree, and Dennis isn't there. Not far away is the Appalachian Trail, and Mr. Martin, who's in really good shape, takes off and sprints for a good solid 4 or 5 minutes down the trail. Nothing. Comes back. They look around. They search. Both families search. They find nothing. The grandfather says, "Hey, I'll run down the trail and go get more help." Well, as Mr. Martin is there with this other family, the family introduces themselves, and one of the weirdest things I've ever written, this other family's name, their last name was Martin as well. What are the odds? So within hours, you know, the infantry arrives. I mean, dozens of National Park Rangers start scouring this area. And within 12 hours, it starts to rain. And within 24 hours, it's rained 6 inches. Like a huge storm just completely envelops this area. So the search goes on for weeks. Somehow or another, the Green Berets are called. And they fly into the park in helicopters and land. And there's almost 100 of them. And they start searching the park for this little boy. Nobody's ever heard of this before. And nobody thinks it's ever happened before that the Green Berets are searching for a little boy. Now, since I first talked about this maybe 6 years ago, I've had Green Berets call me and go, "Hey, that's BS. We do not search for kids." I've got pictures of the Green Berets there, of their commander, of them in uniform at the park, and in documents from the Park Service. They searched for this kid, for Dennis, for almost a month, and they didn't find him. They didn't find anything. As Dennis was disappearing, about 3 miles away, there's a family, and I'm not making this up. Their last name is called the Key family, and this family is key to this case. They're up a trail, down the Appalachian Trail, a few miles, and as they're walking up this one valley, they're looking for wildlife, they see something running on the side of the hill up above them. And the one little boy tells his dad, "Hey, it looks like a bear." And his dad looks and goes, "That's not a bear. That's a man running around up there on the side of that hill." And at the same time, they hear this gigantic scream, and they think, "Wow, that's really weird." But they live about 40 miles away. They finish their day. They don't know any kids disappeared. They get in their car and they go home. 2 days later, on the front page of the Knoxville Sentinel is a picture of Dennis Martin and the disappearance and the time and all the relevant facts of the case. They go, "Oh my God, we might have seen something that was related to this." And they read that the FBI is arriving at the scene that day. They call the park. Park says, "Oh yeah, we want to talk to you about this, but don't come to the park. We'll send people to you." Well, they send some investigators from the Park Service and the FBI to interview the Key family. Mr. Martin had an agreement with the Park Service superintendent and the investigators that anything that they had, they would tell him about immediately. Days go by. Mr. Martin never hears about this. And a reporter from the newspaper happened to hear about it from somebody else and told Mr. Martin. He went livid. And the Park Service apologized and said, "Oh, it's no big deal. Don't worry about it. Nothing, nothing, nothing." Well, Mr. Martin got a hold of the Key family directly. So the Park Service says, well, it's impossible that the time frames don't match up. So the time they saw this on the hillside and the time your boy disappeared, there's no way someone could make that distance. Well, the head tracker for the Park Service heard this and told Mr. Martin, that's a lie. You and I will hike it today, and I'll show you how and where it happened. So they hike it. Mr. Martin realizes, wow, you can do it in that time frame. Long story short, they don't ever find Dennis. They don't have any leads. They don't have anything. And the case goes stagnant for 50 years. Myself and another investigator go out there, and we're doing follow-up before I write the event. And I just went out and knocked on Mr. Martin's door. He lived in the same house that he and Dennis and his wife lived in when it happened. He comes to the door, and I recognize him. Thin man, still in pretty good shape, quite old. And I explain who I am, how I traveled there from California at the time, and I'm writing a case about Dennis, and I'd like to talk to him. And he said, Mr. Politis, because this has haunted my family for 50 years. I've been lied to incessantly by everybody about this, and my wife and I are trying to put it behind us in old age. He's a very nice man. And I said, Mr. Martin, you're looking at somebody who knows more about this case than anybody else you know, other than yourself and your wife. Would you please give me 5 minutes? He goes, I'll do it. Steps outside, and he talks to us for about 20 minutes. And he answered a lot of my questions and concerns. And I brought up the Key family, and I said, well, they said that they saw somebody running around that mountain that kind of looked like a bear and looked like a man, and I couldn't understand that. And he goes, well, they didn't print the majority of the facts around that. And he goes, what the truth is that they saw somebody supposedly wrapped in animal fur running around. He goes, the most important thing that they didn't print and refused to print is that the Key family said that whatever that was they saw on the side of that mountain was carrying something on its shoulder. And he goes, Park Service wouldn't tell me the truth. FBI wouldn't tell me the truth. Nobody would tell me the truth about why the FBI was there or what they learned. He says, it's been an entire mystery our whole life. I can tell you for a fact, Johnny, myself and this other investigator walked away from there with tears in our eyes. You could feel the horror that this man and this family had gone through because of incessant lying by the Park Service.
Why the need to lie or to hide facts?
So we went back, and the tracker for the Park Service is still alive that talked to Mr. Martin. And we asked him, we said, what in the heck is going on here? And he said that 4 months before this happened, there was a Park Service ranger in a far portion of the park that was attacked by a man living off the grid in the woods, and this ranger was almost killed. And this is before the days that the rangers were authorized to carry firearms. And he said that the Park Service didn't want to acknowledge that there were people living in their park off the grid that they couldn't control, that they couldn't find and arrest, and they didn't want to admit that one of these people could have committed a major crime like that and gotten away with it.
Yeah, I think that some of this withholding of evidence and information is because they're afraid that if they say something, that it will drive people away from the parks. Or any other event that something negative happens, they always try to cover it up or whitewash it in some way, spin it so that it's not as negative as it may appear, simply because they're afraid that it will drive people away from their attraction. And that's how they make their money. I mean, I can understand some of that. I mean, not that it's right, but I can understand their motivation.
And you're not telling people not to go to national parks, right?
Oh, heck no. I mean, you're talking to somebody that goes into more parks than anybody you know. I'm in there all the time, and I encourage everybody to go to and visit a national park. But I also tell them to do it with intelligence. I mean, if you're going to go and take a hike, especially if you're going to go hiking by yourself, which I highly do not recommend, but everybody ought to be carrying a personal locator beacon. And that doesn't send, I mean, these things are about $200. If you get lost, you pull it, activate it, it sends a message up to a satellite. That satellite sends a message to the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. It shows your GPS coordinates. They call search and rescue for that area, and they come out and find you within 8 feet. This one device would alleviate 90% of all the missing people in North America. And I wish everyone would take it. I mean, if people have watched Deadliest Catch and they hear about an EPIRB is essentially a personal locator, but it's for a boat. And that sends out the same signal, goes to the same agency, and they send out the same search and rescue. But everyone ought to be carrying those. And I can tell you, every place I go in the wilderness, I have that and a satellite phone with me all the time.
What other advice could you give folks before going out on a hike.
So when I go into these parks, I see families treating the park like it's their backyard. They don't keep an eye on their kids. They let them run around aimlessly without supervision. A park can be a really dangerous place, and you don't understand how fast people can disappear innocently in those locations. If you have kids, you need to keep one eye on that kid all the time. Do not take your eyes off of them. Have them in front of you on the trail. Don't let them get behind you. Keep an eye on them. Now, carry a day pack with you. Carry your water and an extra water. Always carry a whistle. And in fact, if you have a small child, put a whistle in their pocket and explain to them, hey, if you don't see mommy and daddy, you blow this whistle. Always carry some energy bars. Check the weather before you go out anywhere to hike, hunt, whatever. This is one of these mistakes that people make, and it turns into a disaster. Tell someone that you trust in a big way where you're going and when you're coming back. And if they don't get a text message from you by the time they say you're going to get a text message, they're going to call search and rescue, and they can't be hesitant about it. They got to call. Carry a personal locator beacon. This item's $6 in a hunting fishing store. It's an emergency blanket, and it's real light. Throw that in the backpack. Carry that with you. If you can't or you just refuse to do that, this sounds stupid, but it has so many uses. Carry a really large plastic bag. That can be used as a tank top. It can be used as to crawl into and sleep in. Keeps you out of the elements. It's a huge lifesaver. And then lastly, every time you see me in a park, I always have a gun with me. And I don't tell people, yeah, you've got to carry a gun. But if you are trained with a gun, if you feel comfortable with the gun, you carry the gun. In 5,000 cases I have researched, I have never read of one case where somebody was carrying a firearm and had a personal locator beacon and vanished. How odd is that? A lot of hunters that have vanished, but they weren't carrying a personal locator beacon.
So have any of the cases that you've written about been solved? Have they found the person?
So in my world, solved isn't finding the person. Sometimes finding the person opens up more doors of ambiguity.
Okay.
As an example, I've written about maybe 50 cases where, let's just say, a 2-year-old child disappears from their parents on the trail. And they're found 3 days later, 2 mountain ranges away and 10 miles away, deceased, laying on the ground. That doesn't solve it. To me, that adds more questions to the case.
Right.
And you think, well, you know, maybe somebody abducted them and carried them. Yeah, but this is in the middle of nowhere. And people say, well, maybe these people are abducted. So even I'm in pretty good shape. I run 4 or 5 miles a day. If I picked up, let's just say, a 100-pound person in the middle of the woods, I couldn't carry that person quickly more than 100 yards without sitting down to rest for 5 or 10 minutes. So the idea that this is happening by abduction of a human being, no, that's not happening. And if that was happening in the woods, I live in Colorado, you'd be hearing about people killed on the trail all the time because we all carry guns. So it's something else. The distance traveled is in a table that I placed in several of these books that shows the age of the victim, the distance they were found from the point last seen. And search and rescue books don't even want to attempt to address this because it skews their grids that they put down on these kids. Now, like, let's just say a 2-year-old kid is supposed to be found in a 2-mile radius from the point they're last seen. Well, then how can you explain these kids found miles and miles way further than that or way higher in elevation than they were last seen? Doesn't make sense.
How about some of the clothing that which is found in some of these cases? Aren't there some kind of suspicious circumstances regarding the clothing, any clothing found?
A lot of times, search and rescue will say, oh, well, the victim had hypothermia, so they start stripping their clothes off. And that's their excuse. And they'll just throw it out there, and they'll walk away, and the public eats it up. But when you start to look at the cases, a family says, well, yeah, I last saw my child at this location, and his clothes were found 200 yards away in a neatly stacked pile in the middle of the woods. Well, 200 yards, your child could cover that ground in about 3 or 4 minutes. There's no time for hypothermia to set in.
Right.
And people don't want to address this. I have a whole handful of cases where that was exactly the scenario that search and rescue gave, but the family said, well, Mr. Politis, one huge problem. My child can't undress themselves.
That is weird.
It is weird.
Oh.
It really puts the parks and the national forests under a different set of glass that you look through. And for me, it hasn't changed. For me, I love to fish. So I'll hike 10 miles to find a good fishing spot. I used to do it in a somewhat carefree manner, but now my senses are much more aware, and I'm trying to always sort of understand how my environment may change as I'm walking. There was a hunter a couple years ago that was in northern Colorado hunting for elk above 10,000 feet, and he was in this big field, and the grass was like 3 or 4 feet high. And he said he all of a sudden felt the ground rumbling. This guy's like Mr. Credible, Mr. Integrity. Didn't want anybody to know his story but me. He said, hey, I don't care if anybody believes this. He goes, it happened to me. And subsequent to that story, I've heard it from other people. So he's in this meadow, about 10,000 feet, feels the ground rumbling to his left. And he thinks it's a herd of elk coming his way. So he grabs his rifle, he's getting ready. And then all of a sudden, about 100 yards away, he sees the grass parting. But there's nothing there, and the grass is parting at a fairly rapid pace from a position left to right from where he's at. And it starts 100 yards away, but the distance is closing as it approaches in front of him, maybe 50 yards away. And he says, I'm seeing, but I can't believe what I'm seeing. And he says, it's fast, it's going, the grass is parting, there's obviously something there, but I don't see it. And he goes, I picked up my scope, I looked at it through a scope, and I'm seeing what I thought I was seeing. And then he goes, it keeps going to the right, and it disappears over a knoll. And he goes, I don't even know what I just saw or what I just experienced, but that's it. Then another hunter in Colorado told me an even more bizarre story. Said that he was walking up to elevation by himself looking for elk. He said it was a cloudy day, cold, and he was in about second or third mile of the hike, and he was sort of hiking slightly uphill, getting tired, had his head down slightly. And then all of a sudden he looks up, and he said it's almost like there was a mist in front of him like 10 feet down the trail. And he said, that's the best way I could explain it, mist or like smoked glass. And he goes, all of a sudden I slowed down, and I walked up to it. And he goes, I took my foot and I put it up to the glass or the smoke, and like the 2 inches of my boot that went in disappeared. He goes, I quickly pulled it back, and he goes, I got scared. And he goes, then I took my rifle and I stuck it in, and it, the end of the rifle disappeared. And I thought, I want no part of this. And he turned around, and he goes, I didn't run, but I hiked super fast looking over my shoulder behind me at this.
As we were talking here, the first thing that comes to mind, alien abduction, of course. And then it's Bigfoot intervention. And then the other thing, which is kind of what you were talking about, is interdimensional travel. I believe that there are vortexes and interdimensional gateways that people can actually go through, maybe get lost in. Have you ever looked into anything like UFO abductions or Bigfoot abductions or interdimensional type travel?
So one of the key points is that there's, on these search and rescues, they bring in professional trackers the vast majority of times.
Yeah.
They're looking for tracks, evidence that the victim left the scene, anything left the scene. There's never any tracks. They bring in canines. There's never a scent trail. So that eliminates a lot of the common things that I would come first to my mind and maybe would come first to your mind. And then in the 2-hour special I did for the History Channel, Vanished, they flew me to Wisconsin where I met with a theoretical physicist named John Brandenburg, one of the smartest guys I've ever met. He said that there are at least 5 countries in the world right now studying portals. And he goes, Dave, I don't mean just casually. I mean, they have a whole team of physicists studying them. He said the going theory is that portals and time travel and et cetera are doable. We talked about it on air for several minutes. And then I asked him, I said, well, is the thinking that portals could be directed? The reason I ask that is that many of these cases have this point of separation, meaning the person's going down the trail, they get out of eyesight, something happens, they're gone. Well, if portals were natural and accidental, then you and I and Johnny should be able to walk down a street somewhere in downtown Seattle, L.A., and if these naturally occur, people would see people disappearing in front of them.
It's true.
This never happens. It's almost as though there's some directed intelligence that waits for the opportunity, and the person's gone. And Brandenburg said, well, that's interesting, Dave, because there's studies being done about that right now to see if we can control and direct.
So, Dave, we're going to have to wrap it up here. Where can I get your books or your movie?
So you can go to YouTube and watch some videos about me. The only YouTube channel that's mine, it's called Can-Am Missing Project. If you see David Politis Missing 411 on YouTube, it's all hoaxed. It's all fraud. Don't believe it.
Okay.
Website is called thecanammissing.com. That's where you can get the books.
Thanks for spending time with us today here on Strange Harbor.
We really appreciate
it. Great talking to you guys. Thanks for having me on, Johnny.
So what do you think?
He's really good. He's credible. You know, he has a way of presenting things that's very factual.
Yeah, he's total research.
Straightforward, so that, you know, there's very little doubt that, you know, that he's making anything up. And sometimes, you know, especially in this, you know, in this paranormal field, where sometimes there isn't a lot of detail or a lot of evidence, hard evidence, it's easy for people to make things up. And I don't think he does that. I think that having read his one of his books and talking to him here, I get the sense that this guy is totally credible. He's gone out of his way to avoid speculating.
Anecdotal evidence.
Yeah, and trying to fabricate things. He's straight up. This is a straight shooter.
Right.
You know, and he's...
more facts, less feeling.
That's right.
I have to give you a little bad news, though, Bill.
What's that?
We record the video for the Strange Harbor Uncut on our website.
Right.
So you can, like, watch the show, too.
Yeah.
During most of the interview, I don't know what happened, but your camera froze, and it just had just you sitting there. I mean, it looked like you were just sitting there listening, but it was you kind of frozen with no motion, even when you ask questions. I'm trying to figure out, as we're going along here, what's wrong, and I finally was able to fix it. So, like, I want to say that, like, the last 5 minutes, I was able to reactivate you, and you're animated again.
Oh, wonderful. You know, I hate it when I become unanimated.
Right.
And there's another un-word I can use, unanimated.
Well, that'll do it for this episode of Strange Harbor. If you want to contact us, yell at Bill for his New Age hooey. Watch or listen to back episodes. Read some strange stories. We got a lot of strange stories on the website.
Yes, we do.
If you want to give us money, you can always give us money.
Yeah. Where do they send it?
StrangeHarbor.net.
I wouldn't hold my breath for that one.
Right. Are you going to do your little sign-off thing?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm waiting for you to finish.
You're waiting for me to shut up?
Just shut up. Give me a sign.
Okay.
All right. So stay strange, my friends.
You're listening to Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at StrangeHarbor.net. Strange Harbor. Be strange.